This is the Down East Journal on Public Radio East. I'm Jared Brumbaugh. The barrier islands of the southern Outer Banks are famous for their wild horses and remote, uncrowded beaches. These landmarks, such as Shackelford Banks and Cape Lookout Lighthouse, are only accessible by boat. But that doesn't stop people from coming. Almost 600,000 people visited the Cape Lookout National Seashore last year. Park Superintendent Pat Kenny says Cape Lookout is trying to make the barrier islands more accessible to everyone by implementing a passenger ferry service.
Following the passage of the Concessions Improvement Act, we started the process of looking at the need for adjusting to our ferries, and we completed a plan in 2008 that calls for the creation of concession passenger ferries here at Cape Lookout.
Kenny says the creation of a concession ferry contract would create a gateway to the state park from Beaufort and Harkers Island.
The town of Beaufort is actually our partner. They will be providing space inside the new town hall, which is the old historic post office right on Front Street. They will be providing dock space right across the street in what is now Graydon Paul Town Park.
Passenger ferry service would also be available from the Harkers Island Visitor Center.
I think that's the one thing that we really feel is going to be beneficial to at both locations is it creates, allows the visitor to make contact with the National Park Service, talk to the National Park Service about their visit, get information about the park prior to going across to the islands.
Proposed fees for the park's new ferry service haven't been revealed, but Kenny speculates the cost could range from $10 to $30 round trip per person.
Under the new system, we would collect franchise fees, and those revenue would come into the park. That revenue would be utilized to go right back into improvements for visitors and protection of the park resources.
A public scoping meeting took place Thursday at the Coeur Sound Waterfowl Museum, during which park officials shared details of the plan, discussed the environmental assessment currently underway at the site on Harkers Island, and took comments on improvements needed to facilitate passenger service. Cape Lookout National Seashore Superintendent Pat Kenny is excited about the plan.
We need to do some changes to the marina here to ensure that the docks, that we have adequate dock space and sufficient safety precautions in place for loading and unloading passengers off of boats. We're looking at the parking situation. We're looking at restroom facilities.
Cape Lookout National Seashore is also in the process of developing descriptions of services to be provided. The prospectus will go to privately owned passenger ferry businesses already operating in Downeast Carteret County.
Then based on that, the proposals received back from interested companies will be evaluated against a set of criteria, and then we will make a recommendation and a decision based on that to move forward and select a contractor for that service.
Perry Barrow has owned and operated Outer Banks Ferry Service in Beaufort for over 25 years. They currently provide passenger ferry service to the Rachel Carson Reserve, Carrot Island, Shackelford Banks, and Cape Lookout Lighthouse. Barrow says he's interested in contracting with Cape Lookout National Seashore.
Who chooses this is an independent committee, and part of their selection process is who's the most qualified and who's been doing it the longest, which is me.
Barrow says if he can get the contract, he could have a monopoly for the ferry services in a certain location for a certain period of time, which is usually 10 years.
So once you see the prospectus, what they want, certain things, larger boats, this and that. So, you know, you can speculate all you want to, but until you see the prospectus to bid on it, you don't know what they want.
Cape Lookout National Seashore expects the prospectus to be released before the end of 2013. Barrow says there are about 10 privately owned passenger ferry companies that operate in Harkers Island and Downeast Carteret County. This week, we contacted passenger ferry businesses in Beaufort, Harkers Island, and Bogue Banks to hear how the contracted ferry service would impact their business. While they declined to be taped for interview, the consensus was that the plan would threaten their business. When asked if Cape Lookout National Seashore was duplicating a service that is already being provided, Park Superintendent Pat Kenny says,
"Under the current situation, we do not have control of the schedule, and we can provide regular service to the public that want to go to the national park."
An estimated 80,000 people use private passenger ferries to access Cape Lookout National Seashore annually. Kenny believes that providing its own passenger ferry service, Carteret County and the Cape Lookout National Seashore could see an increase from tourism.
When they plan visits, they seek out national parks. By having a seamless system that as far as finding transportation to these offshore islands, would potentially result in a growth.
The Cape Lookout National Seashore released a passenger ferry transportation feasibility study, which lists how many people would use the ferry service for the next 12 years. According to the mid-range forecast, ridership from Harkers Island could increase by almost 8,000 visitors by the year 2024. The mid-range estimate for people departing from the Beaufort site would increase by over 6,000 visitors over a 12-year period. That number may not seem like a lot, but when you factor in ferry fees, the move would mean more tourism dollars flowing into Harkers Island's local economy and improvements at the Cape Lookout National Seashore. Kenny believes the park's new ferry service could begin operation in the spring of 2014 once the environmental assessment is complete, facility improvements have been made, and local ferry services have been contracted. The public comment period for the project will remain open through October 15th. For PRE, I'm Jared Brumbaugh. This is the Downeast Journal. In the year 2012, parents of school-age children have many options in how to educate their youngsters. Public and private schools are usually the first to come to mind, but there are also charter schools and a growing number of children being homeschooled in our state. There are currently 50,000 homeschoolers in North Carolina. L.C. Morris has more on the educational facts surrounding homeschool.
Numerous reasons can be cited as motivation to homeschool children. Three reasons selected by the majority of homeschooling parents in the United States reflect school environment, religious or moral instruction, and dissatisfaction with academic instruction at public and private schools. Mike Marshall is the president of North Carolinians for Home Education.
Studies have shown that statistically, homeschool students score 15 to 30 percentile points higher than the national norm on standardized tests. And so there's academic advantages. Again, I mentioned being able to customize your curriculum to fit your child. You can incorporate their interests, their natural talents. You can work on their weaknesses. You know, they'll tend to become independent learners, which is certainly helpful in going on into college and in life in general.
Choosing to homeschool can be a disadvantage all in itself. It can be physically, emotionally, and financially challenging. Parents who homeschool are primarily responsible for purchasing the curriculum needed, which can cost approximately $400 per child per year. It has been said that homeschool programs, no matter how well designed, are no match for a nationally recognized curriculum with examinations and accreditation.
Here in North Carolina, if you're going to teach, there's no other certification required. You basically file a notice of intent, again, with the state, with the Division of Non-Public Education. You show your proof of a high school diploma or equivalent, and then you're basically certified, you're authorized to then begin homeschooling at that time.
In North Carolina, once a child turns 7 years of age or will turn during the school year, that child can be then homeschooled through the age of 16 or further. If parents want to start earlier, they can at age 5.
There were some laws in place that permitted parents to teach their children at home. They were not specifically homeschool statutes as such, but there were other provisions that were used for that purpose. And at that time, of course, there were a lot of legal problems that parents had about whether it was even permissible for them to teach their children at home in a homeschool environment.
Disenchanted with the current education system is what has driven some parents to pursue homeschool. Since 1983, the homeschooled has been protected by the Homeschool Legal Defense Association, a nonprofit advocacy organization established to defend and advance the constitutional right of parents to direct the education of their children and to protect family freedoms. Dee Black is a senior counsel with the organization.
There is still some element of hostility on the part of public school systems about homeschooling, because after all, these students otherwise would probably be in the public school system, and so their state funding that's lost when these students are not enrolled in public school. And so I think that's something that the school districts don't like particularly.
Black is responsible for legal matters involving the association's members in 14 states, including North Carolina.
Homeschoolers not being enrolled in the public school are not public school students, and so would not be subject to the same legal requirements as homeschool as their public school students. I mean, for example, in the area of curriculum, it depends on the state that you're in, but some states have curriculum requirements for homeschool students. In most cases, they're not the same as for public school students. There's more leeway given the parents to plan which subjects are taught in which grade levels. And then there are other states, for example, like North Carolina, where there are no designated required subjects.
Although some studies show that homeschooled students can do well on standardized tests, some of those studies compare voluntary home testing with mandatory public school testing. Homeschooled students in the United States are not subject to the testing requirements of the No Child Left Behind Act.
In the case of North Carolina, there is a requirement that homeschooled students receive standardized testing each year in certain subjects that are, you know, of course, tested by standardized tests. And so there's an implication that these subjects would be taught in order for the student to perform well on the test. But there are really no designated subjects in North Carolina for non-public school students, you know, unlike those in the public school.
Black says homeschooled students average 37 percentile points higher on standardized tests than their public school counterparts.
For the most part, state laws authorize parents to conduct a program to evaluate their students' progress and then determine whether that student is prepared to move on to the next grade. There are a lot of different resources for homeschool students online through different programs where there may be an evaluation of the student's performance in a course through that means so that it's not done directly by the parent.
Since social skills are learned through interactions, it is often said that homeschoolers lack opportunities of forming friendships with their peers and do not learn how to communicate or behave in group settings, which can result in animosity and resentment towards the parents and siblings, which is who the students see 24 hours a day, 7 days a week.
We're seeing a trend that the states are passing laws that authorize homeschool students to participate in extracurricular activities at public school, such as sports, band, clubs, things of that nature. For example, this past legislative season, Alaska and South Carolina were two states that implemented laws like that. And so we are seeing that there are times when we have to work with public school officials to get a student into that sort of a extracurricular program.
On an average, according to the National Home Education Research Institute, it costs $546 per child per year to be homeschooled. This includes field trips, computer software, and materials for projects. Racial statistics regarding the success rates between public and homeschooled children found that there were no significant variations between white and minority homeschooled students. Examples of this could be seen as K through 12th graders, regardless of race, averaged a percentile of 87 points. However, math saw a white average of an 82nd percentile achieved and a minority average of 77th. For more information on homeschooling, visit nche.com and the Division of Non-Public Education's website at ncdnpe.org. I'm L.C. Morris.
The Down East Journal is made possible by our members in partnership with your local Edward Jones Financial Advisors, Michael Bass and Kevin Page in New Bern, and Alice Cundiff in Swansboro. Branch location information available at edwardjones.com. Edward Jones, making sense of investing. This is the Down East Journal. There are about 100 wineries and 400 vineyards in the state. For reasons of tourism, new attitudes toward alcohol, the local food movement, and the muscadine grape industry, among others, the wine industry in North Carolina has grown and continues to bring solid economic benefits to the state. Stephen O'Connell has this report on the booming wine industry in the state and right here in eastern North Carolina.
Before Prohibition began, North Carolina was a leading producer of wine in the United States. But when Prohibition was enacted, the alcohol industry in North Carolina all but died out. Since its repeal in 1933, the wine industry has risen, and for the past 15 years, the number of wineries and vineyards has substantially increased.
There was a recent economic impact study that was commissioned by the North Carolina Wine and Grape Council that showed the economic impact of the industry to be about, I believe it's $1.28 billion on an annual basis.
The Extension Viticulture Specialist for North Carolina at North Carolina State University, Sarah Spade, says the scientific finds of wine's health benefits is a major contributor to its growth.
The health reports related to particularly red wine consumption have helped the whole wine industry, and it's not just a beverage, it's part of the meal or experience, or it's not just a drink, it's a food as well.
Buddy Harrell shares the same sentiment. Harrell is part owner of Bennett Vineyard, located in Edward, a community in Beaufort County. He is a large producer of the less well-known Vitis rotundifolia, commonly known as the muscadine or scumpernong grape. Harrell says the grape stands apart from the better-known vinifera and labrusca blends of wine.
These grapes only grow in southeastern United States, and they produce anywhere from 8 to 45 times the antioxidants you find in any other grape in the world.
Even so, the viniferas and labruscas dominate the wine market, and in North Carolina are grown predominantly in the western region. In eastern North Carolina, the vinifera and labrusca don't produce nearly as many grapes as in the middle of the state and are highly susceptible to disease. Fortunately, the muscadines are immune to the east's harsher climates, so much so that they are even used to combat disease such as Pierce's disease in other regions of the state.
They use the rootstock of this Native American grape to graft their vines to. They keep the root rot from killing them off.
Harrell says his grapes were not immune to the recent Hurricane Irene, which cut his production down, and he is now only able to sell his wine in North Carolina.
I'm going to plant another 10 or 15 acres, hopefully, within the next year to 2 years, because the demand for these grapes keep increasing, and I sell a lot to other wineries other than what I use in my own wine, but the more popular my wine gets and the more I sell, the more grapes I have to keep for my own wine.
Harrell has 7 different wines on the market, his biggest customer being Harris Teeter, and recently a company in the eastern world approached Harrell.
We have signed a contract with Hong Kong, and they want to put our wine into 25 foreign nations.
At one point, Harrell was selling his pomace, the skins, pulp, seeds, and stems of the fruit, to a company in New York that produced pharmaceutical pills. But the practice became so popular that he discontinued it, and now strictly uses his grapes for drinking.
There are over 8,000 wines on the market from every country in the world, and they're all different grapes, all different wines.
The diversity of wines is a key factor in the economic success of the wine industry. Another factor, says Extension agent Sarah Spade, is the economic downturn, which has caused an increase in staycations, the rise in people staying more local for a getaway. She says changing attitudes towards alcohol consumption has also created stronger interest in wine drinking. Owner and operator of Duplin Winery and Vineyard, David Fussell, references the increase of people moving from northern states as an influence in common southern perceptions of wine. Duplin Winery, located in Rose Hill, is the oldest winery in the state and is the biggest wine producer in the East. Along with their own vineyard, they've signed contracts with 49 families throughout the southern states to grow grapes for them. He distributes his wine to 13 states. In 2011, 92,000 people visited Duplin Winery. Fussell credits government support.
We have a great deal more support from the government here in North Carolina through the Agriculture Department or through the Department of Commerce. They have seen that wineries are a great economic tool to help in times of recession, and we are able to drive people into the state for tourists, and so we're able to collect dollars. So they put a lot of support behind promoting the North Carolina wineries.
Much of that support goes to the Piedmont region, which has about 72 vineyards and wineries and rises far above the East's wine sales. Max Lloyd, owner of Grove Winery in Gibsonville, located in Alamance and Guilford counties, says the local food movement is creating popularity for wine.
People are realizing now that if they buy a bottle of wine that, you know, weighs 3 or 4 pounds from Australia or New Zealand, that's halfway around the planet. That's got a huge carbon footprint. And there's also something special about, you know, tasting wine, you know, right where it's grown.
When asked about the East's future prospects for wine, Lloyd says there's room for some growth, but considering the humidity and temperature, doesn't think there's much potential for anything but the Muscadine blends. Bannerman Vineyard, Bennett Vineyard, Grateful Sisters Vineyard, Huffman Vineyard, Duplin Winery, Silver Coast Winery, and Lumina Winery are a few of the winemakers in eastern North Carolina. In this state, there are now more than 400 individual grape farms that exist, covering 1,800 acres. In 2005, the economic impact of wine was $800 million. And with the monetary value now at $1 billion, one can only expect more of an increase in a state that's been able to reestablish an identity in the wine industry. Stephen O'Connell, Public Radio East.
This is Ann Edwards, Horticulture Extension Agent, with this week's entry in the Garden Journal. I've started planting my fall vegetable garden after pulling out the last of the tomato plants, and have been thinking about what makes fall vegetable gardening so different than most other times of the year, and so absolutely rewarding. My fall garden consists mostly of leafy greens of different types, a wide range of lettuces. This year I added some radicchio, a couple collard plants, lots of curly kale, wonderful peppery arugula. There's broccoli. Now that's not a leafy green, is it? Although the leaves are edible. And I'll probably plant some root crops. Beets, carrots, turnips, maybe even rutabagas. But they take a lot of space and I don't have much. But I realized the one thing that all these plants have in common that make them particularly wonderful for a small garden like mine. It's that you eat pretty much the whole plant. It's not like a tomato or a pepper or a squash where you have long vines and huge leaves or big tall plants with stalks and stems, and then a fruit here and there. With the leafy greens, you pick those outside leaves and you eat the whole thing, and then the next week you pick the next layer of leaves on the outside. And you keep doing that all winter long. Every inch of vegetable space in the garden is an inch of vegetable that goes on the table. Even with the root crops, it's that way. You pull up a carrot or a turnip and you eat the whole thing. Of course, the salad greens, you eat them. I love buttercrunch salad, and it grows so well here. And I mix it with some other kinds, maybe a few red leafy salad greens. For all these plants, you don't have to worry about flowers and pollination. So if you want, you can use row covers to protect them from some of the insects that might otherwise bother them. And most of the insects on these leafy greens, they're caterpillar-type insects, so they all can be treated with BT, the caterpillar disease. So I don't have to have a lot of other chemicals out in the garden. And I love that. What else is great about gardening this time of year? Well, the soil is so nice and warm that if you plant seeds directly in the garden, they pop right up. I planted 2 rows of rapini on Sunday, and already I have beautiful rows of young plants cotyledon leaves spread to the sun, ready to start growing strong. The plants that I put in as transplants, well, I've been watering everything twice a day because it's been so hot and so dry. And in less than a week, they've at least doubled in size. Some of them have tripled in size. It's amazing. Water really can be the limiting factor this time of year with the heat and the wind. So if you're putting in transplants or seeds, water, water, and water some more. You don't want the bed to be saturated and soggy, but trust me, for most beds that's not going to happen, particularly if you have a raised bed area. You can grow all of these wonderful greens, whether it's the lettuces or the heartier greens that you cook, in a pot on your back porch as well. You don't need a garden. That's another reason that this is a great time of year for growing. That small space yielding a big harvest again, just in a slightly different form. So get out and start your fall garden, and I'll talk to you in next week's entry in the Garden Journal.
Thanks for listening to the show this week. If you have questions, comments, or ideas for features, you can drop us a line at the NewsHound link on the homepage at publicradioeast.org.